Among the things that make our region a spectacular place to live, rivers figure prominently. No big, flat, muddy rivers for our part of the world, thank you very much. We like our rivers twisting and falling and often very clear. Yes, there are some exceptions. Our guest this hour made it essentially his life's work to explore rivers and streams in many parts of the country. Tim Palmer is the author of around 24 books, many of them on rivers, including Field Guide to California Rivers and Field Guide to Oregon Rivers. By last count, he had canoed or rafted more than 300 rivers in the United States and Canada, and that may be updated now. Tim Palmer, thanks for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Great to be here. I'm eager to visit with you about our rivers.
Well, and I just understand, as you told me a few moments ago, you took a particularly notable trip not that long ago with your wife. Tell us about the Rogue River journey.
That's right. My wife, Ann Valisis, and I had a fabulous 15 days doing the entire length of the Rogue that is boatable from the base of Lost Creek Dam the whole way to the ocean.
Which is the first time you've had a chance to do this, I'm thinking, since the removal of Savage Rapids Dam and Gold Ray Dam.
That's right. 20 years ago, we did as much as you could do then without a dam, which was Savage Rapids Dam out. And now we have a lot more river to do. So it was a great trip and a real eye-opener about this river that's the artery of our region.
What was the biggest eye-opener for you?
You know, I think the biggest thing was that, you know, the Rogue is nationally famous as one of the outstanding whitewater wilderness overnight trips. But doing the whole river showed that it is far, far more than that. You know, it's just an incredible community river as it goes past near Medford, through Grants Pass, and other communities. It's a phenomenal wildlife river. Just for comparison, I just did a 100-mile trip on the Skagit River of northern Washington, which is wilder in some respects. Has great salmon runs still going there where ours are threatened and in trouble. But here on the Rogue, we actually saw more bird life and more wildlife in general. So even through our communities, it's this phenomenal wildlife river. The fish in it are essential to our economy, to a commercial fishery, to a huge sport fishery, to our whole identity as a region. The headwaters flow from Crater Lake. So it's this river of many faces and many values, and doing the whole thing of a piece really just showed how remarkable it is.
That's quite a journey. I mean, I've rafted stretches of it myself, and of course, there's lots of people who will go up from Shady Cove. They'll get the shuttle up and start where you started, just below Lost Great Dam, and then about three beers later arrive in Shady Cove, and that's their trip. You're talking about 15 days of doing this. Did you camp along the riverside the whole way?
Yeah, we sure did. And it was just very cool to keep going and going and going, you know, day after day. Day four or five is usually the end of a Rogue River trip, and Ann and I were just getting warmed up at that point, you know, used to the routine.
What were some of the big surprises? I mean, you'd done stretches of the river before that you could do.
That's right. You know,
from Savage Rapids on out. And, of course, with Savage Rapids gone, you could go much farther upstream now.
Yeah.
Talk about the places you'd already been and whether you'd noticed any differences.
You know, I didn't notice remarkable differences, which is what we want to say. However, there are some. You know, our climate is much warmer today. The river is way warmer. And this, of course, has been an incredibly low water year because we had very little snowpack. That's a sign of things to come. The water temperatures go up. A lot of problems occur. There's a whole domino effect with this kind of climate change occurring. And so even though it's not totally evident in the river, that's very much a part of the scene. What was evident is a lot more algae. You know, the warm water and the high nutrients in return water from our sewage plants and irrigation and whatnot caused the water to get much bigger algae bloom.
So, really? And we're talking about the moving sections of the river.
That's right.
We're in no dammed sections.
That's right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Of course, one of the great changes was those three dams that are gone. And you actually can hardly tell today. You know, it's remarkable how quickly nature can heal if you just give it a chance. And so these three dams that once blocked the river only a few years ago, you know, they're wide open riffles and beautiful sections of river. You see a little bit of the remains of the dam, especially Savage Rapids, which is just a reminder that there is hope and that we are making headway.
So I was going to ask you about what is visible at those stretches. So let's talk about going past where Gold Ray Dam was.
Gold Ray, you hardly see anything there. You know, there's a riffle there and just a bit of foundation is left. Likewise with Gold Hill Dam. And what we now have are two really big rapids on the Middle Rogue. They're actually bigger rapids than anything on the river below, which is notorious for its whitewater. these two rapids, Nugget and Tillamook, are just phenomenal steep drops, you know, that look very intimidating. I had never run them. And so Nugget is fairly easy to scout, but you look at it and say, wow, that's a big drop. Just what is it going to do to us? We didn't know. And there was no one with us, you know, nobody to follow, nobody to watch. And so that was very exciting. And then Tillamook, which used to be called Powerhouse, is even more amazing. It's a little bit easier, but no less intimidating because you can't see it. You can't even see it from either side of the river on a scout, except for way downstream on the river left side. And it's the steep drop that's basically barriered away by islands. Mm-hmm. So from either shore, it's hard to see. So as you come into it, you see the entrance where two big guard rocks, and you have to slip through a narrow slot between them. And then you just plunge down about a 12-foot drop in three or four pitches. And it's totally amazing and fun and great.
And did you end up staying upright the whole way?
You know, we totally aced it. We lucked out. The river gods were with us. Yeah, and it was a terrific, really fun run.
What are the things that other people would have to do to be able to follow in your footsteps? You need some permits and guides in some cases, don't you?
Well, you do need a permit for the wild section of the river that's administered by BLM. So we did not get a permit in advance. You can get a permit months in advance. We did not do that, but it's fairly easy to get a permit from people who had one but canceled it, especially late in the year after the end of summer. You know, you can get pretty good luck at getting. So we had no trouble getting the one permit we needed.
Okay, let's pick this up on the other side of a break. We're talking to Tim Palmer about his trip down the Rogue River. And it's part of a larger discussion about the general health of rivers because Tim is spending a lot of his time and attention and his life on looking at rivers. Field Guide to Oregon Rivers, Field Guide to California Rivers, among his many books. We'll come back and talk more with Port Orford's Tim Palmer and take your phone calls and emails when we come back to The Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about water today, but water in specific channels. We're talking about the rivers of the region, which Tim Palmer, our guest, knows very well. Tim lives in Port Orford, but he spent many, many years traveling rivers around the United States and Canada and writing lots of books about them and taking lots of pictures of them as well. His most recent works are Field Guide to Oregon Rivers and Field Guide to California Rivers. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about particular rivers around the region and raise some issues you might have with the rivers, because chances are Tim knows what those issues are and what might be done to address those. 800-838-3760 around the region, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we're just talking about you and your wife, Ann, taking a 15-day trip down the Rogue River from Lost Creek Dam all the way to Gold Beach.
The ocean, yes. Mm-hmm. We could see the ocean surf out ahead.
Mm-hmm. Really? You got that close?
Yeah, we did.
And so you had done most of this before, correct?
But from Savage Rapids Dam down. So there's a nice reach above that was now new.
Mm-hmm. And so talk about what are some of the real standout things you saw on the way down the river?
Well, wildlife the whole way was amazing. You know, bird life, more osprey, more great blue heron than you see typically on rivers. So that was a real highlight. Of course, the whole thing is just beautiful. You know, there were hundreds and hundreds of houses along the midsection, which we pretty much gulped down all in one day. We actually slept on the raft one night because we didn't have good public land nearby to sleep on. And so we found a secluded little spot and just made our beds up on the raft itself. And in a way, it was one of the sweetest nights of the whole trip. But but that was, you know, those were aspects of the river that were really key. And then other great things were the wildness of the Rogue River Canyon, the big rapids. You know, the two big rapids that are now run on the middle section of the river. And, of course, in the lower canyon, the famous Mule Creek Canyon and Blossom Bar Rapids are just amazing, too.
Did you have to portage any places?
No, we didn't. Nope.
Really?
We could
ran
run,
them all.
We ran the whole thing. Yes.
Wow, that's impressive.
Ann was in her kayak. I rode the raft with all our gear, including food for the whole 15 days, and water for most of the trip. And occasionally, Ann would tie the kayak onto the raft, you know, for like late in the day, perhaps to give her a little change of pace, and so that we had time to visit on the raft together. So we kind of mixed it up that way too.
Granted, you did this recently, right?
Like that's right, just a couple of weeks ago.
All right. So, given that it was, the end of the season, were there days when you just didn't see other people?
No, we always saw people. I mean, there were miles when we didn't see people. But there's a steelhead and a salmon run going on, so we saw anglers the whole way. You know, lots of guys in drift boats fishing, lots of people on the shore. But you know, one of the surprising things was that I thought there would be more people just outside and sitting along the riverbank. I mentioned we saw hundreds and hundreds of houses. Rarely was there a house with somebody sitting on that deck that faced the river. They all just seemed to be empty. And so I was surprised at how much people relate to the river and that we've built along it, but how little people seem to actually be out there enjoying it and using it too. And in a bigger sense, this reminded me of other problems, which is connecting our young people to the natural environment today. You know, and I would have hoped on the weekends we would have seen kids by the hundreds out playing in the water and wading in the river and swimming. And we didn't really see very much of that. This trip was autumn, but we had 100-degree days.
Well, yeah, the weather was certainly good enough for it, sure.
That's right. And so I kind of thought there would be more of that.
Tim Palmer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the Rogue River at the moment, but we'll talk about just about any river you'd like to talk about if you'd like to join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. That's an interesting perspective, though, that the river's there and people make a point of living next to it, but just not making a lot of use of it.
That's right. That's right. I mean, yes and no. I mean, there were people there, but I thought there would even be more. Mm-hmm. And I think what that points out is that at some deeper level, we need to recognize the value of places like our Rogue River. I mean, it's absolutely the greatest community asset we could have, not only a wilderness asset, but it runs right through these towns. It's accessible to thousands and thousands of people. We now have bike trails along a lot of it in the middle section, which is terrific. But it would be good if it were recognized more as the center of our society and culture than it is. And I think we're on the right track in working in that direction with groups like Rogue Riverkeeper, Klamath Siskiyou Wild, Trout Unlimited, Oregon Water Watch, the Native Fish Society. All these groups are working toward a better Rogue River and toward making improvements in it, and working toward reconnecting people to this great natural asset of our community, our culture, and our greater environment.
It seems like our attitudes about rivers have continued to evolve over time. I mean, that you started this process, I'm thinking 30-plus years ago? Is that fair?
That's right.
Okay,
that's
right. So granted, that was still 10, 15 years after the passage of the Clean Water Act, and that was another 20 years or 5 years of the passage of the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act after the Cuyahoga River burned in Cleveland. So that was like sort of the low point for American waterways. We don't tend to use them as open sewers and waste disposal anymore. But have we done enough? I mean, did you think we'd be a little farther along in our treatment of our streams?
Well, first of all, you're right, Jeffrey. We have made great strides. I mean, these three dams that we just talked about are one illustration of that. They're basically useless old bucket of bolts dams now. We got rid of those. We have a free-flowing river again. Our water quality rules are much better. So though the sewage waste from communities along the river was evident. I mean, just in the faint smell of odor below the, where the sewage discharges occur. Nothing really gross, but you could tell there was something wrong. Foam began to appear below White City, and it lasted the rest of the river, and there was none above there. So we made great headway. But yet that's not to say that there's a long way to go. And we're really handicapped now because of this huge issue of climate change, which will have a domino effect of warming up the water, making the habitat much less conducive to the native fish that we treasure so much, our salmon and steelhead. It means that floods are going to get worse. So we have to take steps that, you know, that people are reluctant to take. We have to, for example, we have to do a better job at steering development away from the floodplain. The Federal Emergency Management Agency imposes floodplain requirements now in order to get flood insurance, but they're not strict enough. I mean, they still allow development in the floodplain, and floods are going to get worse, so the risks that people are exposed to are going to get worse as well. We need to do a better job at that. We need to do a better job at shading the riverbanks. There's a big effort to do that now, with a lot of public money being spent planting shade trees along the river to try to get that water temperature down. That's a great effort too.
In fact, the city of Medford, the Medford Water Commission, is involved with that whole process, I believe. Deliberately getting some trees planted as part of a cooperative effort.
It'll be a great experiment to see if we can really make headway in that regard.
So it's interesting to think in terms of, with the climate changing, the water gets warmer, even if the things you're doing directly to the river are generally beneficial to the river. The fact is that the broader zone of humanity and the earth around it can still make changes to what goes on in the river.
That's right. So we face, unfortunately, increasing challenges all the time that way. Basically, we need to do two things about that. One is to deal directly with the problem of climate change by reducing the source of the problem, which is the fossil fuel industry. And we could earmark that and come back and talk about that more if you want. But the other thing is to build in resilience to our natural systems. And we do that recognizing the climate is going to warm inevitably at this point. We need to do things like have more open space along the floodplain, have more shade in the riparian community, have fewer diversions from the river so that we have healthier flows. We need to have cleaner water, less irrigation return flow, which adds temperature, high temperatures, and nutrients to the water. We need to do all of these things. This has basically been the agenda of river conservationists for 50 years, but because of climate change, we have to do all of it more, better, and faster.
Tim Palmer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about rivers. He recently took a trip down the Rogue River all the way from Lost Creek Dam to the ocean at Gold Beach with his wife. So we've been talking about that. We're talking more broadly about rivers. Tim has authored many books, including The Field Guide to Oregon Rivers, The Field Guide to California Rivers, and California Glaciers, I remember well, too. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. Talk about your favorite river and some of the challenges you see there or some of the gains made there. Or join us by email at jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking about the floodplain. And I mean, how much bigger an area are we talking about? Because when you drive up the river, for example, in Shady Cove, there are houses hanging right over it.
Yeah,
and I'm wondering if you're talking
exactly
about, making changes in places like that.
Well, it could be. I mean, it's all a very, it gets to be a technical question of where the floods will occur. Mm-hmm. And so floodplain mapping is done by hydrologists, so it's impossible just to say. But generally, I can say we're not doing enough. You know, that there is too much development too close to the river.
Now, let's talk about stream buffers, because this is one of those things that just gets fought about over and over and over, particularly between the timber industry and environmental groups, where there's this argument over how broad a section of trees you need to leave next to a stream and a constant struggle over that. You know, the timber industry is saying, well, it's okay if you leave just a narrow curtain of trees, and I forget the exact numbers at this point, but then the environmentalists pushing for broader buffers all the time. I mean, you've been out there and looked at a lot of these streams. What do you see in places where there's been timber cutting?
This is a really good issue to talk about, Jeffrey, because in that whole issue of warming waters, timbering is a big source of warmer waters too. Not because it warms them extremely like urbanization does, but just because there's so many acres involved. And there are two approaches that are worth talking about here. One is the Northwest Forest Plan, which has ended up giving us better regulations on federal lands on the west side of the Cascades, including setbacks from streams and buffers that have been very successful in beginning the path of restoration for those thousands of miles of public lands, rivers. we need to not back off of those standards. There is pressure to do that. But we're just seeing the beginning of success on that. And the millions and millions of dollars we're spending on salmon and steelhead restoration would be at risk if we back away from that again. The other half of the approach here is the regulation of private forest lands, which is done through the State Forest Practices Act. And it is notoriously lax in its standards in this regard. There have been study after study showing that we need good buffers along our streams to protect them, to keep them cool, and that we just don't have enough of that under the standards that we now have. There are 100-foot buffers, but even within that, many trees can be cut. And if it's a small stream that's not fish-bearing, there are no buffers at all, as if that stream doesn't feed streams that do have fish, or as if fish wouldn't be in that stream if it were cool enough. So there's a lot of headway that we need to make in that regard, too.
I was going to ask you about that particular part of it, because I could just see people saying, well, this isn't really a stream. You know, it does feed a stream, but it's not a stream itself, therefore let's go ahead and cut right to it. And that does happen.
Or it is a stream, but it's just not, adult fish in it, you know? I mean, it is a stream. And even worse are the standards regarding aerial spraying of herbicides. You have the outrageous case of Carpenter Valley near Gold Beach, where 40 residents were sprayed a couple of years ago, had to go to the hospital for weeks. They couldn't even find out what they had been sprayed with because the state law didn't require that. The Department of Agriculture, the Department of Forestry didn't require it or didn't enforce it. We need to upgrade those standards. Fortunately, there was a bill passed the last session that began that process, but after stonewalling that bill for months and months, the forest industry finally signed off so that we got a bill, but it's really just the beginnings of what we need. It's not the end.
Grab a pair of headphones. We have a call for you. We're talking to Tim Palmer about rivers in the region, and he is the author of several books, including The Field Guide to Oregon Rivers, The Field Guide to California Rivers, and here is Greg in Gold Hill. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer. Hi, Greg.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just want to make a comment or two here. I was on a watershed council for over 20 years here in the valley, and I also was asked by the Department of Agriculture to serve on the Inland and Rogue Water Quality team that wrote the plan here for the basin for water quality. And so I know a little bit about this, and I just want to say a couple of things real quick. Number one, I'd like you to talk about the relationship amongst folks that are trying to do something about these problems. It's my opinion, after spending over 20 years involved in all this, that the biggest problem we got is the adversarial attitude that people have towards one another when it comes to these issues. I grew up on a cattle ranch. My father was a timber faller. So I bring a kind of a perspective that might be a little bit different because I am an avid environmentalist. But I do not believe that the solution to these problems is being adversarial. I absolutely believe that out of date, that the answer to these problems is that we should love our neighbors and we should help one another. And over 20 years, I've seen a lot of good intentions, and I've seen some good results, but I've also seen some very bad outcomes that harm property owners. So we have a lot of work to do, but we need to do it together.
All right. So no adversarial attitudes don't help. And what else you got?
Well, as far as irrigation, the biggest problem that we have is return flows. And return flows have been considered to be waste by the Oregon Water Resources Department, or whoever, the water master. And so that's been the case ever since, you know, there's been irrigation pretty much. And this new emphasis on trying to stop these return flows, I'm in favor of it. But the way to do it, in my opinion, is to incorporate the next generation to work with FSA and 4-H groups and things like that and get young people out on the land, hands-on experience, a lot of people, a lot of these farms and ranches that are under irrigation are centuries old, or a century old at least. And when they were originally set up for irrigation, the people lived on the land and they were there to take care of it, and they didn't necessarily waste a lot of water because, first of all,
Okay, I think we lost your cell phone signal there, Greg, but we'll have to pick this up on the other side of a break. We'll do that now. So adversarial attitudes over projects that can potentially help waterways and irrigation return flows or what you threw on the table. We'll come back and ask those of Tim Palmer when we return to the Jefferson Exchange to talk about rivers. Rivers and streams in our region. You can join this discussion as well at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Back to take up the concerns of Greg in Gold Hill and take your comments and questions as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the rivers and streams of our region. They are abundant, they are generally beautiful, and they have generally been visited by today's guest. Tim Palmer is the author of many books, including The Field Guide to Oregon Rivers and The Field Guide to California Rivers. He and his wife, Ann Valises, just recently took a trip down the Rogue River from Lost Creek Dam all the way to the ocean, which is entirely boatable now, because of the removal of three other dams along the river. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about stream issues in our region, and it's a broad region. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So Greg in Gold Hill just dropped off a couple of things for us to talk about. The adversarial attitudes, for one, that he finds in approaching environmental issues. He's from a ranch and timber family, and he says he's an ardent environmentalist himself, but disagrees with the approach often taken. What do you make of that?
You know, I couldn't agree with Greg more that we do need to work together on this and on all these issues, and that there are many opportunities to do that. And at our core, many of us have the same fundamental values of loving the place where we live and wanting to take care of it. And so I just couldn't agree more. And the watershed councils are a great way to do this. You know, this is kind of an Oregon innovation that came with efforts to protect salmon. And it was a whole new approach that really made a point of pulling in people from many points of view. And that's just a great way to go. And I'm thrilled to hear that Greg and others are involved in that. I think there's terrific room for agreement. That doesn't mean that in some cases an adversarial stance isn't appropriate. And let me tell you one of those right now, which is that there are three proposals for strip mining of nickel proposed by multinational and national corporations at the headwaters of our very finest streams, the Illinois, the Rogue, Smith of California, Pistol River, which runs out to the coast south of Gold Beach. These are strip mines that would cause the kind of problems that we find more typical of Appalachia today with mountaintop removal. We don't want that here. We don't need the nickel. There are marginal deposits of ore there. We don't want to see these streams that are absolutely essential to our lives and our economy and our fisheries to be sacrificed by having these big corporations come in. So that's one example where if we happen to disagree with those corporations that want to do the mining, then I think it's time to fight about that, because we can't afford to have that loss.
And these are the areas proposed for withdrawal from mineral activity, correct?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Our delegation has done a tremendous job. Both our senators and Congressman DeFazio have introduced a bill to withdraw these areas from new claims, not from current valid claims, but from new claims, which will help get us on the way to protecting them. And it was just amazing. There were hearings for these bills held just several weeks ago, one in Gold Beach and one in Grants Pass. And there were about 200 people at each one of those. Unanimous support for the withdrawal from mining voiced in Gold Beach, almost unanimous in Grants Pass. Only two people testified against the bill, both with the point of view that, hey, we all use minerals, so how can we deny mining? Which, you know, that's worth thinking about, but it's not to say that we should have mining everywhere. And if we're going to protect some streams anywhere in our country, these are the ones that deserve protection. So anyway, the point I'm making is that in a case like this, I think we need to band together to protect our own local resources. But in many, many, the great majority of the cases, I think there are tremendous opportunities to work together the way our listener Greg has advocated.
The other thing he brought up was the issue of irrigation return flows. I'm not totally familiar with the term. Does this mean where the irrigation canal, having been diverted away from a stream, then comes back into the stream?
Yeah, after the water is used for irrigation and the water that's then returned back to the river. This is not a huge issue today on the Rogue because we don't have all that much irrigation here. It's a much bigger issue, for example, on the Upper Klamath River or in the Willamette. Mm-hmm. But we don't want that to be an issue here either. And so, it's something that we need to address and deal with. But in a fair way, I agree with Greg, in a fair way. I mean, we need irrigation, we need farming, but we don't have to pollute the water when we're doing that. And I think almost everybody, at least at some level, can agree with that.
You mentioned the Klamath, and I did want to bring that up as part of this discussion because that is obviously one of the hotter issues of our region generally, the only river that really starts in California as a major source and then starts in Oregon, rather, and flows through California to the ocean and has the four dams proposed or removed? Yeah, that's right, four. J.C. Boyle, Kopka 1, 2, and Iron Gate. Okay, have you been surprised at the process and the twists and turns it has taken and the fact that we're still sort of waiting for something to happen?
Well, no, not that we're still waiting. I mean, the agreement to get rid of those dams is a hopeful one. It's one whose outcome is far from certain because it takes money to get rid of them. And thus far, Congress has been reluctant to give up that money. And it takes commitments that we're still working on. I and most people are hopeful that that will happen someday. It doesn't mean that the Klamath's problems will be solved because of this issue of irrigation return water and withdrawals. We have those both at the head of the Klamath and on the Trinity River. Great amounts of water are diverted to Southern California,
right,
leaving the lower Klamath, in trouble. So it's a bigger issue there.
All right. A couple more people online here. Ryan and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer.
Well, again, fascinating conversation. Thank you both. I really liked some of the initial comments you made about that sense of community and connectivity. I really wish everybody, had a watershed address and knew what their watershed was and understood the connectivity. One of the problems that I have personally with setback legislation is that it sort of ignores the rest of the watershed in terms of practice, but the role of groundwater and the interconnectivity between rivers and the surrounding hydrology. It's a wonderful, complex, interactive system for which, it's our neighborhood. I'm a Long Tom watershed council participant over many years, and that's my watershed. And so I think about that piece. Impact on the broader community, and I'm trying to think about good ways to get people more connected to that, their impact, their understanding, their appreciation, maybe some inquisitiveness, getting farmers thinking about that connectivity, getting ranchers thinking, urban people thinking about the connectivity, their role in that water, and so I like what you said, but I'm struggling with how to get more people on the river, as it were.
All right. Thanks for that, Ryan. Appreciate that. Let's throw it back to you, Tim.
Yeah. Again, great point, Ryan. We have to be aware of these places in order to love them and understand them and protect them. But there's much we can do. I mean, the first thing you can do is learn about your place. Then you can teach others, especially kids. You can help school teachers to get kids out on the river. There are groups working for protection, not only the watershed councils, but groups like Trout Unlimited, Oregon Wild, Oregon Water Watch. They all need your support, and they all have ideas on what you can do, too, to help build a movement to better protect these places that are our homelands.
I'm not sure if it's Sherry or Cherie, but in Klamath Falls, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I was calling because a very similar along the lines of what the last caller was saying is with people who aren't, used to being active with clean water or quality water or, just working with water, what do you suggest for our daily lives, like small things that we can do that will really make a difference as busy single mothers and other people that can't or don't understand?
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent question. Thanks for that, Cherie.
Yeah. There are dozens of things that we can do to use less water. Just be more careful. I mean, we don't have to use a ton of water to wash the car or to water the lawn. You can let your lawn turn brown in the summer. And so a lot of things we can do on water efficiency and just our own personal care of the place around us. I mentioned before, support groups that want to do a good job on this because they need your help and you need theirs. Pay attention to politics at the local level, the state level, the national level. Pay attention to what our candidates say about what they think about our environment and our waters and hold their feet to the fire to do the right thing. So, vote for the people who are going to do the good job and help campaign for them. So, be involved by teaching for your own personal life, through your political life, and at every level.
And even just using less water is leaving water for the streams.
Exactly.
All right. Let's go to Bruce in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer.
Hi. Thanks. Talking about win-win situations, I wanted to thank the farmers and the Klamath for agreeing to help us get the dams removed. We're saving the spring Chinook down here to restock up there, the wild spring Chinook. But what I wanted to mention was that as far as the farmers up in the Klamath, if we did a marsh treatment system before the water reentered the Klamath from the irrigation, that's the idea I'd really like to see happen. We need to come up with a marsh system to clean the water before it goes back in the Klamath from the farms. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, good point. And especially when you consider that a lot of those marshes are actually national wildlife refuges, which were set up with the primary purpose of taking care of wildlife. There are tens of thousands of acres there are now irrigated. So especially in those areas, we need to do a better job.
Another question from Vajra in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer.
Good morning. What an important discussion. I have a concern that all the political action and motive and activism may be moot in the long run because of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I understand will allow foreign corporations, from foreign countries, to be able to sue our local governments if we don't allow them access to our resources. This very thing has happened in Canada under other trade agreements. And so I'd like to, can you speak to that, Tim?
All right, a common complaint we hear about trade agreements is the idea of them superseding national values and laws.
Yeah, right. It's a horrible situation, and it sets the world up for a race to the bottom of environmental regulation. A big pat on the back to our representative, Peter DeFazio, here for fighting this. I mean, Peter understands this dynamic, and I think it's an absolutely horrible situation. And, what to do about that now, I just don't know, except that we need to come up with a better long-term solution. The trade agreements that we have are not working to do the job that they say they are, which is improving our economy, and they also have the potential here to cause incredible damage to our environment. You're absolutely right.
It'll be interesting to see how things unfold in the years ahead, because this is an issue that potentially can unite left and right, because nobody likes to think about reduced sovereignty over your own resources in return for a little greater freedom in trade.
It's an outrage, and we need look no further than the mining threats I was talking about. Here are multinational corporations, you can't even tell where they are. would destroy our streams for no good reason. And if trade agreements like this make that more likely, then that's just a horrible situation to be in.
Mike in Medford writes, I think there's a view or mindset that is the biggest divide. Environmentalists view the nature as interconnected and vital to all life. This means placing humans as an equal to all things in nature. The opposite view is that of a completely dominant man. Earth's ecosystems and resources are here for use by man. We are a higher being. It would be stupid to give lesser species and ecosystems our, in quotes, precious resources. I think this philosophical view is the biggest impediment to cleaning up our Earth. We are animals living together with other animals, or we are some sort of higher being where all of Earth is some sort of property. Those are the different versions that Mike paints for us in Medford. Thanks, Mike. And how do you feel about that general view of things?
Well, the it's a good point, but let's take a conservative view and just recognize that people do disagree on this. From that limited view alone of doing what's best for people, that's always going to be the best thing for the environment in the long run. We can't the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. And another way of saying this is you can't do business on a dead planet. So even if you do take the view of just what's good for us, what's good for people alone here in the Rogue Valley, that's going to be what's good for this river because we drink from this river. Our bodies are 70% water. All of that comes from river or groundwater that's intimately related. We have to take care of it if we want to do the best thing just for ourselves.
Is that your phrase, the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary?
No, somebody else said that.
Okay, that's a good thing. All right, so Tim Palmer will be speaking to the Native Plant Society with a slideshow on rivers of the region in Science Room 161 on the Southern Oregon University campus at 7 o'clock tomorrow night or tonight?
Tomorrow night,
October 15th.
Love to see you there.
All right. Tim Palmer is the author of Oregon Field Guide to Oregon Rivers, Field Guide to California Rivers, and many, many more books. Tim, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I love being here with you.
All right. Take care.